As the White House threatens to take over state elections, restrict abortion nationwide, and take away our health care, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is the last line of defense for our rights. That's why the Supreme Court election on April 7th is so critical. The ACLU does not endorse or oppose candidates, but wants you to make an informed decision. When it comes to abortion rights, Maria Lazar supported overturning Roe v. Wade and is endorsed by groups that want to ban abortion. Chris Taylor voted against abortion bans and defended abortion rights while working with Planned Parenthood. And on the issue of voting rights in Wisconsin, Maria Lazar defended efforts to rig elections for one political party through extreme gerrymandering of congressional and legislative districts. Chris Taylor opposes rigging the system with extreme partisan gerrymandering. On April 7th, stand up for our rights. Paid for by American Civil Liberties Union, Incorporated.
Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I'm excited, as always, to be able to have the opportunity to bring a great conversation and great guests on this podcast. Today is no different. My co-host and good friend, Sandy Williams, is back in the saddle again. Good morning to you, Sandy. How you doing?
I'm doing well. It's you know, winter goes on and on and on and on. But
well, you know, the only saving grace is we've got something to look forward to, because the winter and part of it is behind us. Yeah. And you know, February starts to change a little bit. Supposedly, we're supposed to warm up a little bit more.
Hope springs eternal. I think winter comes along to remind us of that very fact. It's what makes life better and better, which is tomorrow.
You know, Sandy,
tomorrow.
Hope springs eternal is not just with the weather. You know, right now, hope springs eternal, hopefully with the midterm elections and with, you know, things, Sandy, are really, you know, been turned inside out and upside down. And, you know, you just keep seeing more and more things happening in this nation and globally. And I'll tell you, I haven't lived at a time even more like this. Certainly lived through some pretty tough times in this nation, you and I, but this is really approaching what appears to be just so unbelievable in the scope of all the different things that are going on around us. And so I wanted to take some time to talk to you today about several different aspects of things that are going on in our nation. Certainly things seem to be not stabilized, Sandy. Is it safe to say that?
Well, it's almost as if destabilization has been a strategy in terms of trying to create an atmosphere in which change can happen extremely rapidly. We have a process ongoing in which the original effort is to go to an extremely immoderate position, something that's much further out on the scale in terms of being out on the spectrum of a big change than any of us expect. And then we tend to retreat from that to something which is still beyond what our imagination probably believed would happen, but it now seems moderate in the face of what was a very extreme starting position. So we can look at our tariffs, for instance. All of the tariffs were announced as mega tariffs, you know, 100%, 150% tariffs. But when you look at the actual tariffs being levied, While they're higher than historical levels of tariffs being collected, the fact is that the collection of tariffs last year amounted to 0.8% of GDP, which was actually quite a small number. And if you look at the increase was a 0.8% increase over what was collected the prior year, which is one of the explanations for why the amount of inflation we've experienced in this prior period is not what people were projecting. And it's because the actual tariffs being implemented are far lower than were ever announced. So whereas big tariffs were announced against Canada and Mexico and other countries, when you fell back to abiding by the treaties that we had already entered into with them, the level of tariff increase is actually much smaller. But it's still a very significant impact on the world order.
You know, Sandy, you talked about, you know, the tariffs. That's one aspect of what we are dealing with as a nation. There are many other things. And the term democracy, Sandy, what is the definition of democracy for those of us who don't, you know,
well,
we hear the word?
I think it's not something that's absolutely fixed, but democracies are governments in which the people have a vote, and that vote has an impact on the policies to be adopted by the government. And the extent to which those votes have a direct impact on policies is the result of the organization of the democracy. Our democracy ends up being something that leans more in the direction of being a republic, because the value of each vote is diluted at different levels. So, for instance, in the U.S. Senate, the value of an individual's vote is very much impacted by the population and size of the state in which they're located, because every state, regardless of its population, has two U.S. senators. So the value of a vote in the U.S. Senate is far different than the value of a vote in the House of Representatives, where in the House of Representatives, each representative in Congress represents a comparable percentage of the population, and therefore each vote there is relatively evenly weighted. But Congress doesn't call all the shots. It takes Senate and the president. And, of course, the value of the vote in the presidency is also impacted by the Electoral College.
Well, you know, Sandy, the reason I asked the question is because, you know, you said we really don't have a democracy. It is a republic. But we keep using the term democracy. And if it's not that, then I think we're getting to a point where we need to stop saying it, because one man, one vote is in jeopardy when we've got a person now who's absconded with the votes and the machines of the 2020 election. And that was one person, one vote. And yet it you know, it's like it didn't stand.
Well, the one person, one vote does stand more or less in the Congress. And the way we're set up with the Constitution, Congress, the House of Representatives, is a necessary participant in the passage of laws of almost all kinds. And so, you know, the fundamental bedstone of our version of democracy does include the fact that the House of Representatives is a necessary participant. And that's the way that our current democracy is being tested most extremely, because almost all of what's happened in the past year has been a total bypass of Congress, the U.S. Senate, and the House of Representatives. And it's been carried out by the unilateral action through executive order of the President of the United States, a person who gets elected typically now in today's world with a very fragile majority or even a minority of the vote, so that the president doesn't really represent all of the people. It only represents the constituency that voted for him. But so far, this president has used the executive order, complicit with the Supreme Court's kind of passive approach to trying to operate in a manner that might mitigate the power of that executive order through decisions of the Supreme Court, which have been few and slow coming. So that for the past year, we basically have a democracy which has been throttled by the fact that almost all of the actions of government have not involved Congress.
You know, Sandy, this is clearly a historical period that we're in, where the historians will be talking about this long after you and I are gone, and how this happened, and you know, and why did it happen, and you know, you just get to a point, Sandy, where it's daily, it's a deluge of constantly we're being bombarded with all of this information from all different angles, Sandy, and I think that all of these different things that we're being bombarded with are to cover up something else. I mean, there's so much. I mean, we've got warships, headed towards Iran, and threats being made. We're in Venezuela right now. No, we're not talking about that anymore. We've already gotten there. We did wind up in Venezuela, and we changed the leadership there. No conversation whatsoever about Venezuela. You know, now we're talking about the elections from 2020. You know, we're talking about what happened with the guy who molested all the children, and just on and on and on, Sandy. And it's more than what people can handle. I talk with people who have just shut down, Sandy. They just can't take it.
Well, you know, the commentators, many of whom are centrist in nature, David Brooks, for instance, who I think is probably notoriously one of the most centrist of the current commentators on the scene. And he is now talking about the extent to which he thinks democracy as we knew it has gone beyond the point of no return, and that it's extremely likely that any presidency post-Donald Trump will forever have a different set of rules under which it operates than the presidents who operated before Donald Trump. And one of the reasons for that is that most presidents up through Donald Trump were self-moderating. They exercised the power of the presidency within the norms that they understood were constraints on the operation of the presidency. So norms are something which aren't embodied in law. Norms are embodied in the culture and in the value system of the environment in which someone operates. And what's clearly happened is that the norms of the presidency have been modified, changed, ignored, and completely changed going forward from what they were prior to Donald Trump. And so I'm confident that Donald Trump's presidency will be viewed as a watershed by historians, because it's, as David Brooks and others have commented, it will be very hard for a political leader of any stripe to give up the power of the presidency, which has been demonstrated to exist through the exercise of the presidency outside the norms over these past years. And it's that operation which we're watching in place. The president has always been given a great deal of latitude to operate under foreign policy. But now we have a president who's exercising that will in Venezuela, offshore Iran, everywhere, on the basis of announced or unannounced emergency powers. And it's that same declaration of emergency power which caused the president's office to decide to send federal troops into various cities in the country on a declaration of national emergency associated with alleged crime issues in the city. It's been that same power that's been used to send ICE representatives in massive numbers into metropolitan areas around the country under the declaration of apparent emergency. It's been the declaration of emergency which has been the basis for the exercise of the power to issue unilaterally, arbitrarily, and for any and all reasons, tariffs that would operate negatively with respect to various countries. And it's been that power that's been wielded in a manner that's been different than ever utilized in the past and far more extensively. And we have a Supreme Court which has been very slow to react and we have a number of cases pending which have enormous import with respect to the scale of power that a president can exercise. One of the most important being the tariff power, which is a decision which is still pending. And meanwhile, we have a president who's exercising it unilaterally to modify the relationship with India, with every country in the world, our neighbor Canada.
You know, Sandy, that, you know, you just said a mouthful, and, you know, all those things that you said, the average American citizen sits back and is perplexed. Because all those things you just said really kind of change what happens, the relationship between government and the American citizen. And that's the inherent danger. The American citizen has grown comfortable in knowing, believing that the government was there for the benefit of the average American citizen. But with the things that we see transpiring, that's not what we see. We see the American citizen being left in the lurch.
Well, I am quite confident that people polled on the street, if asked, does the country feel different to you today than it did 2 years ago? Do you feel like the U.S. government is operating in a manner which is affecting you in ways that are different than you experienced in the past? I think an increasing number of people would have answers to those questions and would basically indicate that, yeah, they are seeing and feeling a difference. I mean, Earl, are you seeing and feeling a difference?
Absolutely. This is why I'm saying I'm the average guy. And so absolutely, Sandy, I'm feeling the difference and I'm feeling the unease. And so people are losing faith in government. And the worst part about it, Sandy, is one of the reasons that the president who is the president now came into power was because people said they didn't feel trust in government. You know, and so what? Are we feeling more trust in the government that we have now than we had 2 years ago?
I think not. I have a sense, one of my senses is that there was a frustration amongst people about the inability of government to get things done, and particularly to get things done that were beneficial to them. And so they were willing to elect someone who promised to drop the norms, which seemed to be, those norms seemed to be paralyzing the government. They would drop the norms and they would get things done. Well, I do think we have a presidency now in which things are getting done. And then the question is, what are those things that are getting done and how do the people feel about what it is that's getting done when a president is able to operate close to unilaterally and to exercise the power of the presidency all the way to the hilt? And I think that's where the people are now beginning to shake their head and have some misgivings, because it's like, you know, well, yeah, things are getting done, but it's chaotic, it's arbitrary, it's capricious, it's not necessarily getting done in a manner where I can discern a path that's going to be beneficial to me, Tom, Dick, or Mary. And so, you know, I think that this is an episode, a situation in which the people have given the president a bunch of rope. And now the question is, what's happening with that rope? And is the presidency handling that rope in a manner that will limit its use in the future, you know, is the presidency basically hanging itself?
Well, you know, Sandy, if the presidency is hanging itself, there's some collateral damage that goes along with it, and it's the American people. Because the American people, one of the things that they clearly wanted to see change was the cost of living in this country. And that hasn't gotten better. As a matter of fact, Sandy, it's gotten worse. And there are no signs pointing to it getting any better, because the commander-in-chief is going around the country and saying, hey, it is better, okay? And yet the very people who believed he would change that are shaking their heads and saying, how is it possible that the man we voted for is saying things are better when nothing's better for us?
Well, I think this question of affordability, the notion of the cost of living being out of reach for many people, is a complex question. And I think the politicians had simplified it in the people's minds so that it suddenly became inflation, that the brief period of inflation that was experienced in the early 2020s was the reason why people were having trouble affording life, when that was never the reason. The fact was that over the past several decades, affordability has been a problem that's been the relationship between total family income and total family expenses. And those total family expenses have been hugely impacted, not by groceries, but by the cost of health care and by the cost of housing.
Yes.
And when you couple those two huge components of the cost of living together, you end up finding out why we have a crisis of affordability. And it's the fact that those things have grown at a rate far greater than individual income, and that we have far too many families in America living on the earnings of hourly wage earners, where hourly wages have failed to keep up with this cost of living. So the problem was more complex. People fell into the trap the politicians provided for them of focusing on the cost of eggs or the cost of gasoline, when those are expenses at the margin, which might make daily life more difficult. They're the things which change day to day, which we can understand and realize. But when you look at the family budget, which we've done a number of times, you and I together, you can see that it's the cost of utilities, it's the cost of housing, it's the cost of health care, it's the cost of daycare. It's those things which, when lumped together, put families in the United States behind the eight ball. And we don't have an administration right now which is paying any attention whatsoever to actually resolving the problems in the architecture of our economy which relate to those issues. We talk about housing and trying to deal with the cost of housing, but are there any programs really being discussed now other than at the very margin? We talk about health care. The cost of health care is far more than the cost of pharmaceuticals, but the only thing we have the administration currently pointing at is the notion that they're going to curtail some of the costs of pharmaceuticals, when that isn't anywhere near the largest portion of the costs of health care, which cause U.S. health care costs to be at or equal or exceed 20% of our GDP.
So, Sandy, all the things that you just talked about are absolutely true. But what is at stake here is that you said that there are no programs and there aren't any programs that we see that are being considered, because, as a matter of fact, the government we're dealing with now wants to cut any of those kinds of programs that support the American people in the interim until these things that you talk about that have been ignored for decades can be addressed. And so it doesn't bode well if we can't, the government itself, which is the only entity, Sandy, that can address these problems of the American people. The business community can't. It is the government that has to figure out a way to find a way, Sandy, to bridge this gap until the government can work this out.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing is that the people of the country, I think, are being exposed now to the answer to the question of how would the president they elected behave if he's allowed to avoid the norms that seem to have been constraints on getting things done and can use the power of the presidency in a very unilateral fashion to pave the way for big change. Well, we're watching the big changes, and they aren't being responsive to the problems that Tom, Dick, and Mary can describe for their daily life. And so then what's the reaction to that going to be? And that's really the important question in for tomorrow, for the midterm elections, and for how it is that our republic will respond going forward to try and be responsive to what people are currently experiencing.
You know, Sandy, we have to begin by having an honest Our government has to begin by having an honest conversation with the American people. Yes, we understand what it is you are going through. We're not unmindful of the cost of these things, and we are working on it, okay? But they have to first acknowledge it, Sandy, right? But they haven't acknowledged it. Maybe the people would understand a little bit more if our government would admit that this is an issue, which on the one hand, on left, on the Democrat side of it, they're saying this, we got to get both sides to say it and then work together to address it.
Well, and like I've said on one of our prior podcasts, you know, the difference between supply side and demand side analysis of these problems is like the difference between night and day in terms of coming up with solutions. And the real solutions to these problems require attention to both supply and demand side issues. So housing. Housing is an issue which has become very pervasive in metropolitan areas across the United States. And one of the primary reasons is that's where all the growth in population has occurred in the last 75 years. So we've had sort of a very substantial growth in population, and into the tune of about 200 million people since 1950. And almost all of those people have located in metropolitan areas, not in rural areas. And it's metropolitan areas that have this housing crisis, not rural areas. And so there's been long-term trends that have contributed to all of this. And yet we're looking to try and find the silver bullet. And the silver bullet's going to be complicated for housing. It's going to be finding ways to increase the supply of housing. It's going to be finding ways to make sure that people have accessibility to housing. And there's also just going to be some cultural issues associated with where people live in the future and how they live. Do they live in single-family houses or high-rises in metro areas? And so that's housing. Healthcare. You know, we have a healthcare design that's very fragile, different than any place in the world, consuming portions of our gross domestic product at a rate that no other country in the world experiences, and it needs to be redesigned. But all of these things are steeped in the status quo. You know, there's 20% of our GDP is steeped in the status quo of the healthcare as it exists. We need to find people who are willing to stand up to the status quo and say, look, we need to reevaluate our healthcare system from the roots and figure out how it needs to be redesigned. Very complex issue, requires a great deal of political leadership, and the people are going to need to have to call for it, require it. I think we're examining our democracy now, re-examining it, and we're finding out that in many respects, it's us.
You know, Sandy, it clearly the frustrations that I have with what it is we're talking about and what is happening in this nation is the immediate future for Americans generation wise and generation millennials and others who really are going to be faced and exes who are going to be faced with some really tough, you know, times. You and I and others have watched each decade and each new generation more hope. Our nation provided greater opportunities and more hope, and we all expected the trajectory of our nation to continue with that upward spiral, Sandy. I don't, you know, this is a time that we probably haven't seen where we're headed, you know, since the Great Depression. Maybe not to that degree, but as you stated, trying to find housing, healthcare, these are major issues, shelter, that a great nation like this one didn't struggle with in a long, it's been a long time.
Well, it's been, these problems have been creeping up on us, and we've found ways to ignore them. We've kicked the can down the road, much the same way that we're dealing with Social Security and the solvency of the Social Security Fund, where we kick that can down the road as well. And, you know, there are solutions to these issues, but it requires tough analysis, and it requires people who look to the future. You know, I think one of the lessons that we're learning from China with respect to how they're regulating their economy and how they're accomplishing things is that the Chinese leadership is much more vested in the future than we are. And they're staking their economy out in a manner that seems to be embracing what it is the future will require, while our economy, which is laden with the votes of the status quo, seem to be holding on to what was. You know, we've got a president who believes the economy needs to be returned to being primarily dependent upon energy and the sources of energy which the United States has, in a world where much of the rest of the world is moving away from dependency on that form of energy. So... I think that what's really at stake in our current democracy is the capacity of our democracy to become much more vested in the future and to deal with moving our country into the future in the most positive way, rather than being vested in the past and the status quo and trying to hold on to the status quo and move the country back to something which was viewed as greater than today, when obviously tomorrow will never be exactly like yesterday.
So, Sandy, let me point this out, because I look at China and with that billion and whatever, 3 and 4 billion people, and they've risen and uplifted, you know, 500 million or more people's standards of living. They've done something. They figured something out, Sandy. We've got 340 million, and we can't figure it out. I mean, that's the part of it I don't understand. Well, I do understand, because, you know, we've got 940 or so billionaires, and 40 years ago that was 40. So that's part of the issue right there, Sandy.
Well, I think it has to do with where we are on the curve of development and maturity of an economy and of a society. You know, the United States has, it's been a long time since anyone would accuse the United States of being third world. You know, it was probably the 1850s when we were more or less a third world country for much of our population. But since then, we've moved to the point where we are definitely a first world nation for at least a significant portion of the population, certainly not all of the population. China, on the other hand, was third world until the 1990s, much of its population. And it was, so it got into a growth pattern and a development pattern which was had was far from the point of diminishing returns in terms of its capacity to grow rapidly. And so the Chinese economy has had double-digit growth rates for 25 years, 20 years. It's only now recently slowed down to the 5, 6, 7, 8% a year range. And so that creates a whole bunch of different social issues. I think what is very clear is that the Chinese political apparatus, we can question it with respect to the extent to which it represses civil liberties. We can also ask that same question about our democracy in its most recent format. But, the Chinese society probably does suffer a greater degree of repression than we do in the United States. But it is being operated and decisions are being made from the standpoint of moving China into a future. You know, they've opened up and caused a great deal of competition to occur in China with respect to renewable energy. And in spite of our president erroneously saying that China builds renewable energy but doesn't install it in its own country, China is installing wind energy and solar energy at a rate that is far greater than the rest of the world. And as a result, they're moving in the direction of much cheaper electric power.
You know, Sandy, the frustration that you kind of get when you're looking for answers and people can't get answers on the state level, they can't get answers on the local level, they can't get answers on the national level. But we somehow, I heard the president the other day say that states basically are subservient. He didn't use those words, to the federal government. And I'm like, wait a minute. I thought that one of the things that the right always talked about was states' rights. And now all of a sudden, states' rights have to take a second fiddle to the national government. I mean, all these different things, Sandy, are changing. And, turn inside out and upside down, and, you just have to shake your head.
Well, I think it's symptomatic of a presidency which was based upon essentially no ideological foundation, at least no ideological foundation that found its basis in party politics. So the version of republicanism that might be reflected in MAGA republicanism is nothing like traditional republicanism, and it seems to be premised almost entirely on the will and wish of the leader, the dear leader of the MAGA movement, which is really a big change from ideological conservatism, ideological republicanism, or for that matter, ideological democratic politics or liberal politics. And I think that's where the public is beginning to awaken. They're realizing that putting a great deal of unilateral power, creating a unitary president, an imperial presidency that is in the hands of somebody who is not ideologically bound or predictable, is a very troublesome potential prospect. Because, we have a president who questions Second Amendment rights with respect to an individual who was opposed to his policy and unfortunately killed in Minnesota. And this person is accused of bringing a gun to a protest, which is not something that is permissible, which, of course, those who treasure the Second Amendment would profoundly disagree with. And we have a presidency which looks to the power of the federal government to, for instance, potentially nationalize elections, when the power of the state over the election process within each state has been a most treasured fundamental aspect of the view that states are have the power to be independent from the federal government, you know, in every regard that is not specifically enumerated as being the power of the federal government. And the control of elections has, since the beginning of our government here in the United States, been fundamentally located in local government.
Sandy, can we begin to fix these issues as long as the divide between Democrat and Republicans continue down this path? It's going to take united, you know, front to address these issues, right?
Well, it's going to take, I mean, what I said earlier in this discussion is really been the striking point about this presidency, which is Congress has been bypassed. So we could say that it requires Republicans and Democrats to unify and to come to a view of how our country ought to operate and to reestablish both the rule of law and maybe the rule of norms under which we have operated. But the fact is that almost everything this presidency is carrying out has been done through executive order, which has bypassed Congress, and for which the only moderating influence is going to be the Supreme Court. And we have a Supreme Court which seems to sit on its hands pensively, saying that it's going to be deciding these matters of great purport. It's been reluctant to issue injunctions to keep the things that the president is trying to do unilaterally from going into effect pending the decision. So the biggest thing we can see is tariffs. You know, there's a very serious question about the president's ability to exercise tariff power in the manner that he has. But meanwhile, the court has allowed those tariffs to go into effect and to have the impact that they've had on the world order. We have a world order in which Europe is talking about liberating itself from the United States. We have a neighbor, Canada, which is talking about finding ways to have more trusted partners than its neighbor to the south. All of that has been accomplished primarily through the unilateral and arbitrary exercise of tariff power, which the Supreme Court could have enjoined. It could have at least left the president with more restricted powers while it decided what the breadth of his power was, but it did not do so. And so then the question is, will our Supreme Court, when it comes time to issue this order, find ways to unscramble the egg with respect to all of the tariffs which have been implemented on its watch pending the decision, or what's going to happen?
You know, Sandy, you made me think about America First. And so as we celebrated, many in this nation, about America First, the thought that it should be America First. I guess people never could understand or comprehend the impact of what this was going to mean and how far-reaching it was going to be, separating from China, separating from NAFTA, and separating from NATO. America First sounds good, Sandy, but if you thought it all the way through, it can't be good. You know,
well, I mean, the question is, how is America First interpreted by the person who's interpreting it and then exercising the power? And is it actually in the long run going to put America in a better position than it was in? And I think there's very serious questions about whether the new world order will be better for America than the old world order on some continuing basis. But the fact is that the current administration has done its best to break the world order, to take it and break it from what it was, creating essentially non-world order, with the notion that out of non-order, out of chaos internationally, will come a more powerful America. And, you know, it looks like one version of a more powerful America is this hegemonic view of the world in which China rules the Pacific, the Asian Pacific region, and the United States has the Western Hemisphere, and Europe and Russia deal with one another as they might deal with one another, and let the chips fall where they may. And is that really, in the long run, in the U.S. interest? And I think the fact is what's going to be demonstrated is that version of the world order is going to put the dollar, the reserve status of the dollar in the crosshairs of everyone in the world. It could well destroy that fundamental strength of America, and that being destroyed, we will end up in a far different and more vulnerable position.
Send you to
so America first doesn't necessarily always work out to America in a better position. It depends on how the person interpreting America first interprets it.
You know, Sandy, the worst part about that is we've already started down that slippery slope, right? I mean, and the fallout from America first. You would think that it would take some time for us to realize that fallout, but it's not taking time because we've already cut ties from people that helped make America what it was. Is it safe to say that?
Well, yeah, we've definitely changed the world order, and unless the United States, unless the Supreme Court adjust the power of the presidency in a manner that allows those around the rest of the world to believe that they could have a long-term stable relationship with the United States. Look, the problem with Project 2025 and the notion of an imperial presidency, a presidency that can fundamentally change broad ranges of policy depending on who's elected to the office of president, puts the rest of the world on notice that you can't count on the United States having any sort of fundamental stability with respect to its relationship to the rest of the world if every president coming in can change things and reshuffle the deck. I mean, if the next president comes in and says, look, I'm going to rescind all those tariffs and we're back to normal, the rest of the world is going to say, yeah, but how long are you going to be president? You know, you're going to be president 4 years, right? 8 years. How long will this new normal exist, and how much can we rely upon it? And so whether the American public understands the problems of the instability that's caused by an imperial presidency, don't worry. The rest of the world is watching, and they do understand.
You know, Sandy, you put that in such, you compartmentalize that in such a manner that we can understand, but it's frightening. What you just talked about, that's factual, but frightening.
Yeah. I mean, our current administration has basically torn up as many treaties as more treaties than it's executed. I'm not sure it's really executed any treaties of great significance. We've cut a bunch of deals that are related to tariffs that seem to be unilateral and very arbitrary. And so, you know, we've created a kind of a monster of foreign policy that is dependent upon the whim of the executive in office. And, you know, that might work in the rest of the world where that executive in office is actually a dictator who's in office for a very long period of time. That might create some stability for the relationship. But hopefully that's not what we're creating here in America, although there are some who believe that part of the plan of the imperial presidency is just that the presidency might in turn become imperial. The two term limit creates a fault line in that thinking, and then the question is, what's going to happen to that?
You know, Sandy, I wish we had more time, but we've got to leave it there for now. As always, just chilling but truthful dialogue from you, and it's what I've and people have grown accustomed to hearing when you and I have conversation and dialogue. And let's just keep it going.
Yep, absolutely. Next time.
All right, that's a wrap for what's going on with Earl Ingram and Sandy Williams. See you next time.
As the White House threatens to take over state elections, restrict abortion nationwide, and take away our health care, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is the last line of defense for our rights. That's why the Supreme Court election on April 7th is so critical. The ACLU does not endorse or oppose candidates, but wants you to make an informed decision. When it comes to abortion rights, Maria Lazar supported overturning Roe v. Wade and is endorsed by groups that want to ban abortion. Chris Taylor voted against abortion bans and defended abortion rights while working with Planned Parenthood. And on the issue of voting rights in Wisconsin, Maria Lazar defended efforts to rig elections for one political party through extreme gerrymandering of congressional and legislative districts. Chris Taylor opposes rigging the system with extreme partisan gerrymandering. On April 7th, stand up for our rights. Paid for by American Civil Liberties Union, Incorporated.